there's a lot of mythology about fast food. You know, Johnny used to learn the value of hard work. You know, he'd work a few hours in his first job. That's not the case, folks. That's a romanticized version of a world that doesn't exist. 80% of the workforce in these fast food places, 80% are people of color. Two-thirds are women. The majority are breadwinners. And we have the opportunity to reward that contribution, reward that sacrifice.
Governor Newsom back in September celebrating with fast food workers. Starting Monday, most of California's fast food workers will get a 25% pay raise. Legislation passed last year requires places like McDonald's and Starbucks to increase their minimum wage to $20 per hour. But layoffs have already begun in anticipation of this new reality. Pizza Hut says it's laying off more than 1,000 workers in Southern California, and they blamed this new law. Chipotle says it's raising prices. Some restaurants may automate their ordering and replace cashiers. But even with a pay bump, many fast food workers say it's not enough to afford living in California. Joining me now is Kim Kelly. She's a freelance writer and the author of Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, welcome.
Hi, Jonathan.
Well, $20 an hour is the highest minimum wage for any state in the country. How does that compare to other states?
Gosh, honestly, sitting here in Philadelphia, I'm pretty jealous. You know, our statewide, our minimum wage in Pennsylvania is only $7.25.
Wow.
And there are a lot of other states that are still in that position, though I think about 30 states and the District of Columbia have all increased their state minimum wages, with California really kind of being out on the forefront of that. There are a lot of places where $7.25 is the best you're going to get. So this is a big deal. And I'm really hoping that folks, lawmakers across the country, are paying attention, because if California can do it, why can't we?
Yeah, a big jump. And I mean, when you think about metropolitan cities like New York, where the minimum wage is $16, or even here in LA or San Francisco, are these livable wages for low-wage workers?
Unfortunately, not quite. I think it's MIT that has the annual cost of living tracker. And at this point in California, a proper livable wage would be around $27 an hour. So this is a good jump, a good start, but we're not quite there yet for workers to be able to live comfortably on their labor.
Yeah. And let's bring in, you know, another angle here. One of the concerns of low wage workers is that they don't work 40 hours a week, right? Which means they need to work multiple jobs. Is that what you're finding throughout the nation? Is it pretty similar?
Yeah, that is. I mean, scheduling consistency is a huge issue for fast food workers across the country. Fair working hours is one of the biggest goals of the newly formed California Fast Food Workers Union. Because even if you're making $20 an hour, if you only getting 4 hours here, 6 hours there, that's not going to add up to something that's going to enable you to live.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you factor taxes into all of this as well, right? So, I mean, the money just keeps getting shaved down slowly but surely, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why they're fighting for, I mean, I think the initial ask was even more, right? So this we're getting there, but we're not there yet.
Okay, well, it's still amazing that the federal minimum wage hasn't changed since 2009. It's $7.25 an hour. So, you know, when you look at Alabama, Kansas, Pennsylvania, some of the other states that adhere to this minimum, is that a living wage in those states? I'd imagine no.
Absolutely not. I mean, there is, especially places like Alabama, a lot of places in the Deep South, employers and corporations will move their jobs there because they know they can get away with paying workers less. And they know that the Republican-led legislators in those places will allow them to do it. So it's dire. Imagine, I mean, neither of us could live on $7.25 an hour. A person raising a family, a person with elders to care for, it's just ridiculous. This is why people have to have multiple jobs and why they struggle so much, because we're stuck in 2009, if not 1938.
Right, right. You mentioned that earlier this year, California fast food workers unionized. Let's talk about that a little bit. What kind of effect will that have going forward? Could they see more frequent and maybe better wage increases moving into the future?
I believe that's a big hope. I mean, the California Fast Food Workers Union, they're organized under the umbrella of the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, who do have a national presence, especially in New York and in big metropolitan areas. So really, where California goes in terms of labor, the rest of the country either should go or is trying to go. I think we'll probably see more legislation in more progressive states and states that the labor movement is very strong. Mm-hmm. And gosh, I really hope that this is something that we see across the board. But as always, it's going to take organizing. It's going to take work.
I mean, just how unique is unionizing among fast food workers in America? You know, we're talking about it here in California, but is there a precedent for that anywhere else in the U.S.?
Fast food workers are traditionally one of those workforces that are seen as difficult to organize, but it's not impossible. I mean, a lot of workers have actually been taking things into their own hands and organizing independent unions. Look at the Chipotle workers, for example, and Starbucks Workers United. Arguably, that's a fast food union, and they've been doing incredible things. So it's possible, but it is something that has not traditionally gotten a ton of resources poured into it. Yeah. So hopefully this will change that and show that, look, this is possible, this is doable, and this is necessary.
Well, back in 2012, the Fight for 15 movement emerged nationally. What's been their impact on the fight for a living wage?
Honestly, it's been huge. I mean, back in 2012, it was ironically started by a bunch of fast food workers at McDonald's and Burger King. Papa John's, places that would be impacted by this new California law. And it obviously spread to other industries, childcare, home health care, airport workers. They're kind of everywhere. And it's certainly, there have been other factors, but since that movement took off, we've seen successes on the state and local levels. We've seen different states from Maryland, Jersey, Illinois, Delaware, Massachusetts raise their state minimum wage to at least $15 an hour. We've seen cities like, as you said, New York and San Francisco raise, and Seattle raise their minimum wages municipally to $15 or more. Like, this is something that we saw discussed as a platform in Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2016. Like, I think there's very much an understanding that $15 is not enough. And I don't think we would have gotten to that point without all the work that those workers with Fight for 15 have put in over the past decade.
Yeah. I mean, then there's a question for businesses here, right? So corporations have threatened to cut jobs and raise prices, but they said the same thing, right? When the minimum wage went to $15, how likely are they to do either of these things?
So there have been so many headlines about how a number of fast food companies are already looking at layoffs, already looking at robots, already, you know, sounding the fire alarms. But like you said, they did that in 2015. They did that in 1938, too, when we had the first inklings of a minimum wage for 25 cents an hour. There are so many studies that show that despite the fear-mongering, higher wages do lead to increased worker retention, recruitment, to job growth. It is a good thing for pretty much everybody. And it really just comes down to who is benefiting and who's profiting from these workers' labor. Is it the workers themselves or is it the shareholders?
Yeah. So just to reiterate, I mean, this is a threat that comes online every time we hear about these wage increases. But your take is that likely we won't see any real big changes in, let's say, these fast food locations.
So it's honestly a recent study from UC Berkeley and also from the Roosevelt Institute. It's not just my opinion. Like, we have data, right? We folks have been looking into this for quite a long time. It is overall a net good for the economy and a net good for workers to see these increases in the minimum wage. It doesn't actually have to increase consumer prices or mess with the job market. It's kind of a conscious decision on these employers' part if they want to pass that cost increase onto the consumers or they want to downsize. They don't have to.
Well, I've been speaking with Kim Kelly, the author of Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, just how bad is social media for the teenage brain? We speak with a researcher of the new book, The Anxious Generation, how the great rewiring of childhood is causing an epidemic of mental illness. Plus, we have your weekend film reviews, including the new film, Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. That's all next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Madeline Brand. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill this week that bans children under 14 from creating social media accounts. There's been a lot of research showing social media has caused an alarming spike in depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide among American teens. Experts describe it as a mental health crisis exacerbated by the pandemic, but began by the rise of the smartphone. Joining me now is Zach Rausch. He's a research scientist at New York University. He's also the lead researcher on a new book from his colleague Jonathan Haidt. It's called The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. Zach, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Jonathan, thanks so much for having me on, and hello to all your listeners.
Well, it's great to have you, and let's jump in here. So your research suggests that the smartphone led to a major shift in the childhood experience in the 2010s. So walk us through what happened then and what that looks like now.
So when Jonathan Haidt, who's my mentor, and I, we were working to try to understand what was happening to young people, because we were noticing that, you know, right around in the early 2010s, at first we were noticing what was happening on college campuses. And that was college students were going to mental health centers more and more and more. And what I was looking into was just how big of a problem this was. What we noticed was this wasn't just happening on campus. This was happening among adolescents 10 to 19. And this wasn't just happening in the United States. This was happening all across the English-speaking world, all across the Nordic nations in Western Europe. So this was an international issue. And what we realized as we were doing this research and ultimately now writing this book was that childhood really completely transformed from one that what we would call is primarily play-based, where kids are mostly in person, interacting with each other in real life, and how that very rapidly moved onto smartphones and social media platforms into what we call the phone-based childhood. And this phone-based childhood has had devastating impacts on young people's mental health, their capacity to learn, and capacity to flourish.
Do you have a sense of just how much time, let's say, teens are spending on their phone? And it's interesting because you do talk about this as well, that they're on their phone more and less with their peers. So there's a correlation there.
So in 2009, just about 50% of American high schoolers are using social media almost every day. By 2012, just a couple of years, we're up to 75%. So just a couple of years, we're moving our adolescent social life onto these platforms. By 2015, just about 1 in 5 teen girls are now using social media platforms more than 40 hours per week. We're just talking about social media. And that's 2015. So by 2022, recent Pew Research report found that 46% of teens are online almost constantly. This is the new phone-based childhood where we are forever elsewhere. I mean, I myself experienced this with my own life, and the lives of teens are no different. And they're spending 7 to 9 hours on average per day on screens for entertainment kind of use, and just about 5 hours per day on social media platforms. This is the average.
Yeah, 5 hours, I mean, is a staggering amount. And you talk about how that has become the new childhood. And I know this is kind of like the crux of it and the billion-dollar question here, but what is it about, let's say, those 5 hours that creates such really devastating mental health outcomes?
So it's a great question. And there are many mechanisms through which this is harming young people. But one that's the simplest, and I think something that all of us can easily intuitively understand, is the opportunity cost, which is all of this time that is spent on screens and on social media is time not doing the thing that humans need to do to be healthy, to flourish. And what are those things? In-person social interaction has steeply declined since 2010. Sleeping, also big decline.
Right.
Time with family, time doing almost absolutely everything is being pushed out because these platforms are specifically designed to maximize engagement. They're designed to keep users hooked to their phone throughout the day. And so we're constantly being pulled away from the real world where we develop skills and we develop and we do all the things that we need to feel good.
Yeah. And I think part of the idea here is that there's a better version of us out in the real world when we're face to face with people versus, let's say, Instagram, where there's been really, I think, devastating research looking at how there's major questions of body image issues for young women, which can cause depression, anxiety. I mean, I think there's something, though, in the nature of some of these apps that is very harmful to a young developing brain.
Absolutely. So what we need to really put ourselves into the mind of is what is it like to be an adolescent?
Right.
What are the things that adolescents care about? Number one is fitting in to your friend group. It is an enormous time of physical, emotional, bodily changes. It's a very insecure time. And our brains are not fully developed and we're super sensitive to social cues. So what happens when social media changes from before 2010, it's typically more about social networking. You know, you have your friends that you can post pictures of cats or whatever. You're on a laptop. And now you have new kinds of platforms where you have a front-facing camera on your phone. You are platforming yourself to an audience to be judged. So likes and retweets, and now you can compare your numbers to your friends' numbers. And it's not just with your friends, it's now with the whole world. This is what's changed. It's that we're all now standing on a stage 24/7 being judged by the world.
Yeah. Well, let's also explore this because I feel like with every technology, right, there's kind of the reason that it could be beneficial. And then there's what we could maybe call like the shadow side of it. And I think, though, for some, online communities are the only places that they feel safe. I mean, you know, let's talk about kids and teens who identify as queer, because that's a place, let's say if you're in a rural conservative area, that's the only community that you might find. And I think that some of these online communities were hailed as safe spaces. So how do you think that factors into this conversation?
Yeah, Jonathan, this is such an important question because I think that there's some, in my view, a misunderstanding here about what it is that these platforms offer and what is possible. So I think that it is absolutely the case that, you know, kids from marginalized backgrounds don't find real world community that they feel a part of. And this is a problem that we really need to solve. But I don't think the solution is Instagram or TikTok, right? Mm-hmm. Because just if we take a big step back and just think about what these platforms are, they are not designed for the well-being of really anyone, and especially not kids who are already struggling. So TikTok, for example, is not designed to foster human connection. It's designed to keep you hooked to watch very short videos of people over and over again. And so these are not safe spaces in many ways. And just an example of this, a recent Facebook executive, his name's Arturo Bejar, he was reporting on some research that was done at Instagram. And what he found was among 13 to 15-year-old children, they found that just about 15% say that they have had some sort of unwanted sexual solicitation within the last 7 days, right? So kind of my point is that it's absolutely true that we need to find better ways to help marginalized kids, but this is not the place to do it.
Well, walk us through then a few recommendations that you and Jonathan Haidt come up with. And I mean, if I have this right, it's somewhere in the age of 16, there should be no access to social media. Talk about, again, what you think is the proper way to roll this out and why that number is so important to you.
Yeah. So the contribution that John and I are hoping to bring here is, from a social scientific point of view, is that we're stuck in what are called collective action problems. And what I mean by that is, if you are a 13-year-old girl and you decide that you don't want to use Instagram anymore, you could close down your account, but by doing so, you have just made yourself an outcast, ostracized right. from your entire social friend group. So there are no incentives to do this. And if anything, the incentives are against you. And you might even feel worse if you decide to get off. Mm-hmm. So everyone is stuck in this trap that nobody wants to be the only one not on these platforms. And no parent wants to be the only one who's saying, no, honey, you can't go on to these platforms because it's not safe. But now you're an outcast. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is act together. By acting together, we get everybody out of that trap. So we propose four norms to get kids and parents out of these social traps. The first is no smartphones until age 14. We need to get smartphones out of middle school because this is where the harm seems to be biggest. You know, you can give flip phones. Millennials had flip phones and it didn't seem to have done much harm to them. The second is no social media until age 16. The third is really pushing for phone-free schools. We think this is going to have a huge impact on learning, but also creating that group effect where you could have an entire school without phones 7 hours a day. And the fourth, and this one's a little more difficult, is bringing back much more free play, independence, and responsibility in the real world, where kids can go out and play with each other. Because at the same time that kids were moving on to this immersive virtual world, we were kind of clamping down on kids' abilities to be out and playing unsupervised out in the real world.
Really, really good recommendations. And I also just want to point out that, you know, we as adults are struggling with this mightily. I struggle with it. And you see it in young parents who, to be honest, I know every young parent is doing the best job that they can, but so often you'll see parents on their phones the entire time that they're with kids, they're outside. I mean, it's like there has to also be examples set among those of us that we hope have better executive functioning than a 10-year-old. But the point is that this is really, really difficult stuff for all of us.
I hear this all the time, which is, how could we tell kids not to go on phones when we are so addicted ourselves?
Yeah.
And I hear that. And our brains are more developed. We're better able to handle the constant notifications throughout the day. Just imagine what it's like to be 11, 12, 13, trying to manage all of that, plus all the, you know, ups and downs of normal daily life anyway. So this is really a child welfare issue. This is an issue that we can also make huge strides on, because this is really the only bipartisan topic that people can agree upon. Of course, there are other issues that need to be confronted, but this is a really great place for us to start.
That's right. I mean, if Ron DeSantis and NYU professors can get behind this, I think we're onto something. Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly. And this is, and it's not just bipartisan here in the US, it's in many countries around the world. There is such a deep hunger for this change. And I think we're at a tipping point.
I've been speaking with Zach Rausch, a research scientist at New York University. He was also the lead researcher on the new book by the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. It's called The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. It's out now. Zach, thanks for the time. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Press Play is off on Monday for Cesar Chavez Day, but we have a special show from Public Radio producers The Kitchen Sisters. It's hosted by Frances McDormand, and you don't want to miss it. And Madeline Brand will be back on Tuesday. She'll have the latest legal news and analysis with Press Play's legal eagle, Jessica Levinson. Coming up, is Godzilla now a gay icon?
It's not June yet. It's not Pride Month yet, but Godzilla lights up with a big pink spine, and I just felt, ooh, gay pride.
What to watch and what to skip this weekend, that's next on Press Play. This is 89.9 KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Madeline Brand. It's time for some film reviews. Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are here to guide us through it all. They're film critics and co-hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Welcome back to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
All right, let's jump in here. First up is Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. It's directed by Adam Wingard and stars the two super monsters with human cameos from Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, and Dan Stevens.
She can feel it. Kong, Godzilla, they can feel it too. Something is coming. Something even they're afraid of.
All right, Alonzo, this is the fifth Godzilla film in the MonsterVerse franchise from Legendary Pictures. How does the monster mashing compare to previous installments?
Well, Wingard previously directed Godzilla versus Kong. And if you're a Godzilla fan, you were kind of annoyed by how much Kong there was in that movie and not enough Godzilla. And this time, I think he's doing a better job of trying to balance it. The plot is very rarely the point, unless you're talking about something like Godzilla Minus One, the wonderful Oscar-winning Japanese film that came out at the end of last year. We get a reminder from Japan every so often, guys, this is how you do a Godzilla movie. It's cute that you people in America think you can make these, but step aside, please. But I will say that among the American movies that Warner and Legendary have been doing, this is one of the better ones, just because that climactic battle is pretty great. And along the way, you get little mini battles to keep you interested, because certainly it's not the people that we really care about here.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and Dave, I mean, director Adam Wingard called this film a monster character study. He said he wanted to make a monster film from the monster's point of view. I love kind of throwing some art house ideas into a monster film. Why not? Let's go for it. But I mean, does he succeed? Does this have some depth to it?
I think he's mostly talking about the first 10 minutes where we really feel sorry for sad old Kong, who's alone in the middle of Hollow Earth. There is nothing that you need to understand about any of this. There are giant monsters and they fight. I'm so old that I saw my first Godzilla movie when I was 8 in 1972. That was Destroy All Monsters. Now I get the senior discount at the West Hollywood Aquatic Center. So I have an affection for vintage Godzilla. And I always have to adjust my expectations when I'm walking into one of the current crop, because everything is digital. And I have, because of this, I've resigned myself to the sort of dispiriting march of time that will never again allow for a person in a rubber monster costume to fight on a set of miniature buildings. It's okay. There are many pleasures to be had, even in this digital landscape. There is a big, bad, orange Kong-like creature riding an ice lizard like a big skateboard. There is it's not June yet. It's not Pride Month yet, but Godzilla lights up with a big pink spine and I just felt, ooh, gay pride. Like
it's like when they light up the Empire State Building in June, with a hot pink sheen going.
There are so many wildly visual, pleasurable moments in this film that even if you are old like me and wish for something that will never come again, you can still have a really good time here.
That's Godzilla Kong in theaters everywhere tomorrow. All right, next we have La Chimera, a magical realist film written and directed by Alishe Rohrwacher. Stars include Josh O'Connor, Carol Duarte, and Isabella Rossellini.
Era un mezzo mago. Così ce lo siamo portato con noi. Tutta quella bellezza, i vasi, l'oro. Tutto lasciato lì per un mondo che non si sapeva neanche se c'era. Il mondo delle anime.
This is the new film from Alishe Rohrwacher, who won the Grand Prix at Cannes for her film The Wonders and Best Screenplay at Cannes for Happy as Lazaro. What she cooked up for us this time? She's kind of a buzzworthy artist making some moves here.
Absolutely. Yeah, this time, Josh O'Connor, who you might know from God's Own Country, stars, and he is a British expat in Italy who is kind of running a gang of grave robbers. He has the gift of dowsing, I guess one might say, but instead of finding water, he finds Etruscan tombs. And so he is helping people find and loot artifacts. The thing about Rohrwacher's films, coming off of especially Happy as Lazaro,
she has this great sort of in through the back door way of narrative where you're watching her films and you're not quite sure why things are happening in the way they're happening or in the order that they're happening or why she's jumping around from this character to that character. But somehow by the end of it, it all makes sense. And she has told you a complete story and she had to tell it in that way, where there's this sort of chaotic orbit of characters and incidents circling around each other until they come and fuse in a perfect point in the middle. And so this is a movie that is about theft, but it's also about the value of art and antiquities. It's about the tissue that lies between life and death. And it is it's told in a way that no other filmmaker right now, I think, would do it except for Rohrabacher.
It also looks really beautiful, you know, with gorgeous old Italian homes that are kind of falling apart. So I'm a sucker for that stuff. But Dave, the film digs into memory in our relationship to the past, and it's been called neorealist in the style of films of Roberto Rossellini, whose daughter Isabella, as I mentioned, is one of the stars. So mm-hmm. Is Rohrabacher also playing with film history here?
Oh, absolutely. Josh O'Connor's performance is like something from a silent film. He hasn't got a lot of dialogue. And what you learn about him and who he is comes very much from his increasingly disheveled appearance and his very conflicted, sorrowful expression. She does reference the history of Italian cinema in particular, not just Rossellini, but also Fellini and Pasolini, in the way that her characters work with each other and sort of, as Alonso said, bounce off against each other and sort of dance in a circle until they all come together at once. They are entirely idiosyncratic construction. She's not copying anybody. She is her own artistic force. And she leads you into wonderful and at times mysterious places. And you're, if you're the right kind of viewer, you are always happy to be led there.
Cool. You can see La Chimera at the Landmark New Art Theater starting tomorrow. Next, we have The Shadowless Tower from Chinese art house writer-director Zhang Lu. Dave, this follows a disaffected man in Beijing as he tries to reconnect with his father. Would you say it's a compelling character study?
Yes. But again, almost... Listen, this one kind of has a little bit in common with the Alicia Rohrabacher film in terms of how it deals with its characters. But first, the title, which refers to a white pagoda, which is a 13th century temple in Beijing. And because of its unique design, its shadow is very difficult to see. And that has given birth to a saying that that shadow can be seen 2,000 miles away in Tibet. So what that has to do with this film about, as you said, a meandering middle-aged food critic named Gu Wentong and his relationships that are familial and romantic, that can be found in Zhang Lu's other career. He's a novelist and a filmmaker. So he builds his characters around this fixed center. We see that the past is looming over them like this tower. All of the mistakes, all of the broken family and friendship ties, all of their patterns of behavior. We see them. We see the people intersect. There are visual and character-based ideas that repeat themselves. And this is a very quietly observational style of filmmaking that ultimately, I think, emphasizes a calm acceptance of all the things that brought you to where you are, both the things that you can change and what you can't or won't. It's a very beautiful, thoughtful film, and it's about really the choices that you have in life. And you only have one, and that's kind of to get on with it.
That's right. Well, I'm glad you brought up this theme of time. That's exactly what I want to talk about here. I mean, Alonso, yeah, this is a film that's concerned with the past, the return of the past to the present. Anything else you would add to the themes that come up and how those resonate with those that are watching?
Well, you know, there's a recurrent motif here about people walking backwards, which I think really kind of characterizes so many of the people in the film, in that they're not looking at the future. They are dwelling on the past and where they've already been and how that's put them where they are now. And you also see these sort of generational developments where fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, mothers and daughters kind of do the same things, whether consciously or unconsciously. And so, you know, it brings up that famous phrase about the past is never done with us. It's not even past. And so, you know, there's even a scene where a group of elementary school children are singing a song that is apparently sung in nursery schools in China about how the leaves are all falling off the willow and nothing is as good as it used to be. And all around is nothing but loss. And you're like, my God, 4-year-olds are singing this song about regret and longing. So apparently, wow. I guess the movie is trying to say something about the Chinese character, that this sort of thing, look at the past, is sort of baked in. But certainly in the characters, as we get to know them, they are all grappling with their own childhoods, their own decisions along the course of their lives.
All right. You can see The Shadowless Tower at the Lemley Theater in Glendale starting tomorrow. Last up, we have Wicked Little Letters, directed by Thea Sherrick, starring Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley.
I think you've been set up, Rose. Is there anyone who'd want to do such a thing?
Have you got a pen and paper?
I like you, Rose, and I'd like to bring you to the light.
Why would I send a letter when I can just say it?
Oi! All right, Dave, this is based on a true story. It's the Littlehampton poison pen scandal of 1923. I'd never heard of it. Apparently it was a scandal. It was a real thing. So what happened, and is this adaptation doing it justice?
It is based on a true story, although the film here is immensely fictionalized. There was a poison pen letter scandal in this little seaside town in England. And there was a young woman, a sort of nonconformist Irish woman, who was accused of doing it. But there was very little evidence to convict her, other than that she wouldn't behave herself properly in public. And she uses a lot of profanity. So you think this kind of sets you up for a cozy mystery sort of thing. And it does, until it doesn't. And about midway through the film, they solve the mystery. And then the film becomes about something else. It's all played for laughs, because frequently the film wants those letters to be the location of the humor. That can wear off after a bit. It's also all played very lightly, until these sort of odd tonal shifts when it detours very sharply into brief glimpses of the dark and abusive home life of Edith. And mostly it wants to be about misogyny, but also sort of keep its distance by returning to the contents of these wildly naughty letters. It's kind of the goofy flip side of this 1943 French film from Henri-Georges Clouzot called Le Corbeau, which has a very similar plot, and it was entirely fictional, and it was so bitter and rancorous and so true to life that it was banned by the Nazis during the occupation. So this movie doesn't fully come together the way you want it to, but it is really funny, and I think I would recommend it anyway, because Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley and Anjana Vasant are so wonderful the way they play off of each other. They almost make you forget that there's not a lot else going on. They are terrific and consistently funny.
Well, yeah, Alonzo, this is a blockbuster cast, reuniting Colman and Buckley, who starred together in The Lost Daughter. Talk a little bit more about their performances. It sounds like they hold up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're given pretty basic notes to play, but you do get to know these characters better and sort of understand what's driving their kind of external presentations to the world. And so, the movie does have this. There's definitely kind of a feminist messaging about what the traps laid for women by society in 20th century England, and how those get overcome. And there's a deep bench of character actors here, not only Timothy Spall, but Gemma Jones, Eileen Atkins, Lolly Adefope. And, you know, they make the movie worth watching, because even though the movie reveals the mystery about halfway through, everybody in the audience has figured it out well before the film decides to reveal.
You're not surprised when they tell you.
Yeah, so you know it is. It definitely falls under that kind of like cozy period piece mantle. You know, these aren't wealthy people. It's not like you're there to look at the tea sets and the tweeds. But you know, it definitely has that level of charm to it. And sometimes the charm and the performances are kind of all it has going for it. But that's enough.
Wicked Little Letters is in limited release tomorrow. That does it for this week. Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are film critics and co-hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thank you, guys. This was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Dodgers are back. March Madness is on and Caitlin Clark is breaking records. We'll have a roundup. All the excitement from the sports world. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, filling in for Madeline Brand. March Madness Sweet 16 begins today and tomorrow, and this year has seen a major uptick in viewership for the women's tournament, with all eyes on University of Iowa star Caitlin Clark. Meanwhile, the Dodgers kick off their first homestand of the season against the St. Louis Cardinals. All-star Shohei Ohtani anchors the team in his first season with them, but a cloud hangs over him due to a sports gambling scandal involving his former interpreter. Joining us to discuss is a Sklar brother, just one today, Randy Sklar, co-host of the podcast View from the Cheap Seats. Hey, Randy, thanks for being with us.
Jonathan, great to be with you today. It's a wonderful sports weekend, and there's a lot of great sports coming up in the coming weeks, so I am very excited.
This is, I think, my favorite couple weeks of the year because I'm obsessed with March Madness, so let's jump in right there. What have you made of the tournament? Like, what are some of the big themes and storylines jumping out to you?
So still a lot of chalk, and I use chalk as a term, which means the favorites are still hanging around in both the men's and the women's side. A lot of number one seeds. You mentioned Caitlin Clark in the intro and Iowa. It's interesting because Iowa's great and they barely squeaked by to get into the Sweet 16. And I mean, Caitlin Clark, who is amazing. I mean, let's just call it what it is. You know, there have been great female basketball players through the years, but you said it, like, we are talking about women's basketball. She is a bona fide star and she's incredible. I mean, I don't know how far Iowa can go. You know, South Carolina is unbelievable on the women's side this year. They're a number one seed. They're incredible, probably picked to win it all. You know, but don't sleep on LSU either. They're amazing. Texas has a great team this year. So a lot of the women's favorites are still in the tournament. Notre Dame is a two seed and whatnot. The men's side, there's some interesting, you know, with NC State was an 11 seed and beat perhaps my favorite team in the tournament, the Oakland team.
That's right.
Oakland Golden Grizzlies.
From Michigan, not from California, or if we're talking about the same one here.
Talk about Oakland County. It's a very small school, but, you know, that's the beauty of this tournament. You know, you have all this talent. I look at a Kentucky team that got bounced early. They've got probably three or four guys that will make it to the NBA. And then you got a team like Oakland with a kid who's, you know, 24 years old on the team. I say kid, but they have an older team that's played together in a system that works. And so sometimes that can get you further than just the individual talent that you have on a team. And that's why the tournament is great. One loss and you're bounced.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, just to add a little more spotlight here to the women's game, I want to play a clip from Virginia Tech women's basketball coach Kenny Brooks. I love this guy. I always love seeing him interviewed. And he's describing what it's meant for his players to finally get their due.
Been a women's basketball fan for a long time. I switched over because I wanted to be a women's basketball coach, not because I had to, because I wanted to. In every sense, I've been fighting for respectability. And for it finally to be recognized for what it should be as a beautiful sport.
I love that because, you know, for years, all the prestige were for the men's coaches. You wanted to coach the men's in NCAA or pro, but really the women's game has come so far. The ratings oftentimes are beating the men's games. And I think it's kind of a cool thing to recognize. What did you hear in there?
So I heard someone who loves the game, who doesn't see it as a men's versus women's sort of thing. It's all basketball. And if you love the game, you love it no matter who's playing. All of the players, all boats rise when someone like Caitlin Clark comes along, and you get very excited for the sport itself. Again, I have more interest right now in watching the women's games. I would love to see an LSU South Carolina rematch, which ended almost in fisticuffs on the court. I think what's great in women's basketball now is that it's not just UConn at the top winning every year, year in and year out. It's like, okay, now South Carolina is a powerhouse, and Notre Dame has always been good, and Texas is good, and Iowa has a chance because they have a shooter who shoots the ball like Steph Curry and Caitlin Clark. So we're talking about it, and that's a wonderful thing. And I love all the players that came before her, and they were amazing and are amazing, but we just weren't talking about it the way we're talking about it right now. And that is a palpable difference. Understand the sea change. Maybe the fact that the conversation has changed means that she could be the GOAT.
Oh, absolutely. And we're going to move on here, but I have to give a shout out. My family is from Iowa. We bleed Hawkeye black and gold. Wow. My whole family went there. I just want to say, like, this has changed the state. Nothing has happened there that's exciting in decades. And so I watch every single game I can because I know it's special. So anyway, go Caitlin Clark and go Iowa. moving on to our local boys in blue. There's big expectations for the Dodgers this year with Shohei Ohtani capping off a team that's full of stars. Of course, we're also watching this Shohei scandal opening day. Kind of what are you watching today as the Dodgers take the field?
I mean, as soon as the Dodgers, Jonathan, signed Shohei Ohtani on a team that already has, you know, Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman and still an aging but great Clayton Kershaw and some good young pitching, and they're a fantastic team of just incredible players. I think there was a list of the top 50 players and the Dodgers had in Major League Baseball. The Dodgers had four of them in the top 10. So once they signed Shohei Ohtani for all of that money, I said the margin for error for this team is basically zero. You have to win it all or else the season is a failure. And so to start off right away with this bizarre sort of betting scandal, you know, it's interesting because betting in sports has become a tremendously more accepted thing. There's FanDuel and Bet MGM. There's great, all these sort of betting sites that are now, because of smartphones, you have the access to it. I remember, like, when my dad, if he ever bet on a football game back in the 1980s, would have to know a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy, and that's how you got a place to bet. Now it's on your phone, and you can bet on how many. Can you bet on Caitlin Clark? Will she score more than 27 points in this next game? And you just click it on your phone and there you go. But I think athletes betting on games is where it's still a line in the sand that I think fans don't want to see, because they want to know that the games are pure. And they want to know that if they don't want people betting on games in general, but they, as far as athletes go, but certainly on the sports they're playing, because then in some way it makes it seem like it's not a true outcome. So that is still line in the sand, and that is why it rankles people so much.
Oh, totally. And I mean, the numbers here are crazy. In 2023 alone, Americans bet $120 billion on sports. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's become one of the fastest growing segments of the sports business overall. I mean, just to get kind of the wide angle lens here, how is this changing the industry and how does it impact, you know, fans' engagement with sports?
So I think it's changed in very subtle ways. And, you know, you start to look at, like, people's fandom for their own teams. It's still at an all-time high. But if you've placed a bunch of bets on individual players on other teams and your team loses, but you win all those bets, do you really feel bad that day? So it undercuts your own fandom towards your own team. And I think of in California, the sort of the dissolution of the Pac-12, which was a great regional West Coast conference. All those teams just joined the Big Ten. They're going to be in the Big Ten next year. And so now they're playing games against the Michigans and the Ohio States. And those are great matchups. Those are fantastic matchups. I think it is really good. It is good for for that conference, but I'm going to miss the Pac-12. I'm going to miss that sort of regionality. And I think not that betting has to do directly with that, but I do think that the money in the sports sort of dissolves some of that old regional fandom that I think made the sports so magical and so beautiful. I mean, again, what a Stanford Cal game, what does it mean? You know, what would it mean? It meant so much in the old days of, and I say the old days now, but of the Pac-10, Pac-12, but you kind of lose that a little bit in the same way that, like, if your team loses, but again, you made a bunch of bets and you won those bets, you're like, eh, whatever. You know what I mean? I still won is different from the way we rooted for our sports and our teams. You know, the other aspect is people with gambling addictions. There are many, many people who have those, and this just makes it so it takes the hurdles away from doing it. It makes it so much easier. And so that is a concern as well. But, you know, I do think it takes a little away from the mystique of the sport itself, just rooting for your team.
A much bigger conversation and an important one. That's Randy Sklar, one half of the Sklar Brothers and host of the podcast View from the Cheap Seats. Randy, thanks for joining us. It's been fun.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Zeke Reed, Jack Ross, Kelsey Gante, and Andrea Brody. Brian Hardzinski was our line editor this week. Amy Taw is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer, and our technical director is Mario Saavedra. Come back here tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. And thanks for listening to Press Play. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Madeline Brand will be back next week.